Hello and welcome to my latest podcast episode, which is Jadine Green ASB Chats Private Sector. So I always think long and hard about the topics that I want to talk about within the podcast. And the aim is always to discuss things that are relevant to the people that I think will be listening. And I always think that's likely to be local authority officers, housing officers, police officers, perhaps. So if you've been a follower of the podcast and you've listened to different episodes, then you'll have heard me talking about things that are very relevant to people who work in those organisations. So, you know, we've done things on cuckooing, we've done things on safeguarding, we've done things on partnership working. But I also like to use the podcast as an opportunity to raise awareness of things that perhaps aren't covered quite so regularly in things like podcasts, blogs, etc., but that are just as important for people working in community safety to be aware of. And one of those things that came to my mind when I was thinking about, you know, what can we do for upcoming podcast episodes was about thinking about antisocial behaviour that occurs within the private sector. I think there's been an awful lot of talk, a lot of work over the last few years about making sure we really burst that myth that ASB only happens in social housing. So, you know, it's the council tenants that are responsible for all antisocial behaviour. And I think if you are working in ASB, or particularly perhaps if you work for local authority teams, then you will well recognise that that is a myth. And, you know, ASB can happen in any sector, private, social or otherwise. There are some changes afoot as well in terms of how private landlords might be able to take action in relation to breaches of tenancy around antisocial behaviour, which is why it felt like a really timely moment for me to invite this morning's guest on. I'm really delighted to be joined by Sue Breyer, who is not only a private landlord herself, so brings a huge amount of knowledge and experience of being in that role, but is also a director of her own business, which is a landlord tax training business. And she also works with me from time to time in terms of delivering some antisocial behaviour training to private landlords, which is an area that when we first met, we recognised was something that we perhaps needed to do more in. So I am so pleased that you have agreed to so generously give up your time today. I'm going to start with the really obvious question, which I do in every episode, which is about you telling me a little bit more about you, what you do, and also your experiences.
Good morning, Janine. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, you've already set the scene, so that was lovely. Thank you for that. So a little bit about me. Well, I've been a landlord I think since the dinosaurs walked. That's what it feels like. It must be about over 35 years. My husband and I run a very large, medium to large portfolio. And we have in our time done everything from buy-to-let simple units to development. We're now into HMOs. And now because of the Section 24 issue, we've gone off into holiday lets and taken one of our larger houses out of our portfolio to mitigate the impact of Section 24 and turned it into a business so we can now offset all the interest. I'm sure that will ring true to many landlords' ears who are listening. Professionally, I'm a qualified solicitor and qualified over, I think, 89, I think I qualified. That gives you some idea how long I've been in the property world. Practiced for a fair number of years before making other options. But my secure knowledge of property was the backbone to all the risks and investments that we've made, being able to square up a lease and a mortgage. A lot of things that people learn from experience. My husband's experience as I am now, but certainly in the early stages, though, that confidence, and still now, you know, pulling on that experience through different minefields and property issues and ownership issues, etc. And on the back of that, I then developed my training company, and I've written two tax courses, which I think are completely bespoke for landlords. One is a specialist tax course, which looks at the complete Section 24 issue. I am also qualified as a teacher now, so I use a lot of the maths training that I've done to teach the tax system to landlords through visual pictures, so they access it very quickly rather than listening and reading repeated narratives. I give a visual picture of the tax system so people access that information very, very quickly. And so talk a lot about Section 24. I go into a lot of detail about Section 24, a lot of the hidden detail of how your mortgage interest may not be the lowest of the three calculations, which is taken to give you your tax relief. And then after that, look at all the tax structures, etc. On the back of that, I also have a capital gains tax course. And again, take the whole day to go through capital gains tax course. And then with the group, we do an applied method and formula so people can understand how to attack their capital gains tax. The strength of both courses was that the idea is that with a pen and paper, I would teach people how to work out their capital gains tax. And more importantly, more recently, Section 24, because every portfolio is different. And I'll show you how to dissect yours and put yours back together and work out your tax. So those were my life. That was probably more recently, you know, I see that as my lifetime's works. And then obviously, you know, you and I have been working together and we've you've developed the ASB course and with the private landlord sections that have been relevant that I've taken on as well. And we are, you know, delivering that and working together as one of your associates and developing other courses as well. So it is Super Island or tax training, but there are other courses like the antisocial behaviour course that is being being delivered as well. So I also work for the NRLA, National Residential Landlords Association, and I am the rep for West Sussex, Surrey, and Brighton. So that's another where you might come across me if you were to Google me or to look me up and to know more about me.
Thank you, Sue. I love the fact that you just talk about things like capital gains tax and stuff as if it's just, you know, ABCs and 1, 2, 3s, whereas I'm sitting here just going, Section 24, capital gains tax. and I have to say, joking aside, from the conversations we've had, I love what you talk about in terms of taking things that you've learned through your maths teaching and applying those to help people to understand tax situations, which I imagine there's probably quite a few private landlords who very much are in the same position as me, where kind of steam starts coming out their ears when they start thinking about interest. So I love that you've kind of simplified that down and applied that for people. It's fantastic. So lots and lots of experience, as I said, particularly in the private rented sector. And I want to talk, I suppose, specifically about antisocial behaviour, because I said for most of our listeners are going to be, if not all, are going to be from a community safety background, and we'll have a lot of interest in terms of, I suppose, hearing from the private landlord side of things. We know, I think if you speak to community safety professionals, you know, about some of the challenges of dealing with ASB, particularly for local authorities who will not only deal with problems in social housing, they will also deal with the problems across the private rented sector as well, is sometimes that difficulty to engage and work with private landlords. And one of the things that I'm really keen to chat and tease out with you today, Sue, is the other side of the story, I suppose. Because I know now, which one of the reasons why working with you has been almost so enlightening, is that ability to talk to more private landlords and hear the other side as well, and realise that they too have challenges in terms of engaging and working with local authorities. So I'm hoping that over the next sort of 30, 40 minutes, that if we do our job properly, Sue, that part of this conversation will hopefully result in maybe just opening some eyes in terms of hearing from the other side of things, but also perhaps giving some real practical tips and tricks about how we can overcome some of this stuff and perhaps get local authorities and private landlords working better together. So one of the things that I spoke about when I introduced this episode, Sue, was about the fact that there is a bit of a stigma around social housing, and there does tend to sometimes be this view that ASB only happens within council estates or, you know, on housing association properties. And in fact, you know, the white paper around social housing that was published probably just over 12 months ago now talks a lot about breaking that stigma, bursting that bubble and the mist that surrounds council social housing tenants. And indeed, the Chartered Institute of Housing are doing a lot of great work around that at the moment. With that in mind, and you know, us understanding the fact that ASV does happen in the private rented sector as well, can you tell me a little bit about some of the types of ASV that perhaps you've come across as a private landlord, or perhaps you've heard from other private landlords that you speak with?
Yeah, sure. I've worked with a number of clients, and I tend to, in my mind's eye, see it in a scale of between 1 and 10. And so there can be minor ASBs, if you like, which can be irritating habits within a house, playing music loudly at the wrong time of the day, maybe not respecting other people's things that they might be using in a shared home. So you can have lots of ASB like that. And then that might be about the 1 to 3 scale. Then you get like between the 4 to 5 to 6, where I see that this is becoming a bigger issue, where you going to have maybe low level drugs use, you may have drinking late at night, music to early hours of the morning, just being disrespectful about when someone might do some DIY, that type of thing. But it's all bubbling away there. And then I think that we get on a higher scale towards the 8, 9s and 10s, where there's a criminality involved, but the landlord has the issue of it happening inside. Maybe it might be a single home, and it might be in a shared arrangement with single rooms, or maybe a joint or several tenancy, or at an HMO situation where you have the perpetrator and the victim in the same house, which is very difficult to manage, as to someone who's living in a home maybe, and the noise or the problem is coming from the home, but it's contained. And I think the landlord can deal with all the variety of these at, you know, at any level. And it may not be that they're consistently a 6, 7 or 8 on the scale. It could be it's a 1, 2 some days, and then a 6 or 7 at the weekend. It just depends. But I think we're talking about, you know, lack of respect for the people in the house. And as I say, there's lots of moving parts to the scenarios. You can have, you know, a victim down, you know, next door, and a perpetrator that's your tenant, or you can have it the other way around. Or I think the worst scenario is a house of multiple occupation, HMO, where you've got the perpetrator and the victim in the house. And then you get the issues around powerful personalities that are ruling a little bit, and other tenants withdraw. And I think if things can get incredibly difficult for those tenants, they leave. And of course, then you're left with the perpetrator in the house, as one of my clients were with a 4-bedroom house where all the other tenants have gone because they can no longer tolerate whatever behaviours going on, and the landlord is left now with one tenant who they've got to try and remove, who's got a whole house to themselves. But the types of ASB can be they're so diverse, and it can be so difficult to capture it. The obvious ones will be, you know, drugs, drinking, violent behaviour, that type of thing. But there's also very and music, just not having keeping to house rules, but also it can be even more subtler than that, as someone just takes more control and, if you like, personal space in a shared property, where, you know, they might start just eating other people's food. And, you know, so those we think are minor when we look at the drugs use or drinking or violence maybe, but actually over a long period of time it is antisocial behavior. It is something that is unacceptable if it was done to any of us over a long period of time.
Absolutely. I think I just want to reflect on some of the things you've said there, because I think during what you've just talked about for those few moments, you've highlighted a couple of things that I think are really important. And I think I really liked what you were talking about in terms of, you know, almost having that numerical scale of where behaviour falls in terms of severity. But I think the really good point that you made is the fact that, you know, some days the behaviour might be on that 9, 10 of the scale. On other days, it might be on the 2, 3. but that doesn't mean that the 2-3 is any less harmful. And of course, what we have to do is look at cases in its entirety rather than individual incidents to understand how serious something really is. Because, you know, if we peeked in at a snapshot of time and the behaviour was on the kind of 2-3 of that scale, then actually we might not take the most proportionate response to that unless we see it within the context of the fact that there's been some 8 and 9 behaviours as well. So I think that just really, for me, in my mind, as you were saying that, it really just underpinned and kind of reinforced how important it is that we look at cases in their entirety to understand harm and severity rather than just isolated incidents. I also, one of the things that struck me, and I have to admit, I've never really thought about it before, was your point about HMOs, you know, so where you have got multiple people living within very close proximity to each other. I'm just thinking again, we've been told as a sector very much that the best practice is to think about a harm-centred approach to ASB, where you don't just look at the behaviour type, you look at the impact that it's having. And we know that part of deciding impact is things like, you know, how close does the victim live to the perpetrator? And in this, when we're talking about HMOs, I mean, you couldn't really get much closer. And I suppose that's really important for practitioners to keep in mind, is that when there are reports coming from HMO properties, you know, although the behaviour might seem lower down that 1 to 10 scale, because of the proximity of where the victim lives to the perpetrator, because of the risk of the victim seeing the perpetrator, you know, almost on an hourly basis, potentially, actually the impacts of that could be quite high. And I have to say, it's something I've not thought of before, Sue, so thank you for raising that.
I've been working with clients who've had that happening in even student HMOs. One particular scenario was when the other students left because they couldn't tolerate living with a particular person. And on further investigation, we actually found that the perpetrator had actually lied on the application form and said they weren't charged or, any form of criminality, never involved or charged by the police. And in fact, they were serving a suspended sentence. And was quite violent in the house and threatening extreme actions to the other tenants. So, first-hand experience of that. And the poor landlord was left with him living at the property on his own, the person in question, just the four-bedroom house to themselves, and peddling drugs from it and just seeing out some of his suspended sentence there. So, yeah, very tricky.
And I suppose that is one of the disadvantages, I suppose, that private landlords have, is that they won't have the same kind of information sharing arrangements that perhaps, you know, the council or the housing provider have, and therefore perhaps are housing a bit more of an unknown entity in terms of who people are. And, you know, it's not to say we shouldn't be housing people that have a criminal record or a past, but it's knowing those things so that we can make sure they get the best properties for them in the best areas and the best support to help them to maintain their tenancies. And I suppose that's what private landlords are probably disadvantaged in that way to a certain extent.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's like you say, it's that getting the best arrangement for everybody. The best arrangement in that situation was that the other three tenants were young adults, 18, first time away from home. So it wasn't the best match in the world in many ways. Part of the escalation, I think, within that scenario was they didn't have the maturity or the experience to actually reach out to the landlord or even to their own parents to let them know what was going on. And so the matter escalated with a violent incident and the landlord having to attend the property when it was all unfolded. So really tricky.
Yeah, and I think again you've highlighted the reason why. Again, when we talk about, what factors do we know might make somebody more vulnerable or the impact of ASB more significant upon them, and one of those factors is age. And I think very much when we say that, we often think about, older people. And so if you've got an elderly person who's suffering ASB, that makes them more vulnerable, their age, and that makes the impact of the behaviour more significant. But actually, it's the other end of the scale as well, which you've given a perfect example of that, which is, if you're young and you haven't got the life experience, or you perhaps don't even recognize it's a problem, you don't know who to report it to, then actually being on the other end of the scale and being younger can also be a factor that makes somebody more at risk at harm, because they simply don't have the experience or knowledge to know what to do with the problem that they've got. You can't, we kind of nicely dovetail then into the next question that I wanted to ask you, Sue, which is, what are the challenges that private landlords face when dealing with ASB?
Well, I think first of all, being able to be mentally alert enough to identify it at its early stages, and to be experienced or self-aware to be able to identify it and say, this is antisocial behavior. Where is it on, my mind's eye scale of 1 to 10? How frequent is this? But to actually be able to deal with the ASB, you've got to be able to intervene and capture the evidence. So, in the very early stages, the landlord has to be alert to see how they can intervene, maybe have the chats that are necessary. And if there is if there is one incident or a number of incidents, the most important thing is to capture the evidence straight away and to be alert to that. So this is, as you know, Janine, something that we've talked about a lot, and we've discussed about how we capture that. And in the course that's been developed, the ASB course for private landlords, there's a tool bag of how to capture that evidence at very early stages. So we're talking about the acceptable behaviour contracts, where maybe a very soft chat might do the job, and then the rules spelt out, and then by their agreement that they enter into an acceptable behaviour contract where they accept that they won't play their music after 11 o'clock, or they won't go and eat somebody else's ricicles every morning just because they haven't bothered to collect some the night before for themselves. That type of thing, where you can intervene and manage a situation very, very carefully before it escalates into something nastier, or where the whole relationships start to break down. There's also what I found, and in myself as a landlord and working with the clients, it's very early on. If you're quick off the mark, you will get very good evidence as the dust settles. Because when the thing's very raw, people want to tell you their story, and you can capture the evidence. Later on down the road, of course, dust might settle. They might be living with the perpetrator. Maybe other thoughts have gone through their heads about their own safety, and they may want to withdraw or just look for an easy way out. But remember, you need the evidence. The private landlord needs the evidence in the long term if they need to go to a court at the end, far end of the extreme, if the tenant won't go, to get their possession order. So the landlord has to be very alert and be a businesslike, but also putting at the centre of it the welfare of the victim in whatever scenario they may find themselves in. And the landlord's toolbox, which has been developed on the antisocial behaviour course, is really good at equipping landlords to deal with ASB. And I think the challenges is understanding that ASB has happened, being able to identify it, process that, think about what my options are, and then to intervene and hope it, don't think it's going to go away. I think the best thing is to engage, take evidence, and start the ball rolling in terms of if you find out that it's been happening over a long period of time, you might want to share the diary sheets that are provided in the landlord's toolbox, where the tenant, so I say the victim can record all the incidences, no matter whether it's a 1 or 8 or 9 on our scale of incidents. And what you are starting to do is collect a pattern of behaviour and a pattern. Because a one-off incident, if it's low level, may not by a court be identified as being. sufficient enough. What you're looking for is a pattern of behavior for the lower level stuff, certainly over a period of time, so the judge or whoever's looking at it will be able to get a full picture. So it's evidence capturing at the early stages, and it's something that you said about the victim and understanding the impact. And we talked about how it could be age related as well to young people, and you look maybe elderly people as well, or older people in housing, but we're just how they're vulnerable. But I think what is also really powerful is asking those people who have had it done to them and or feel that they're a victim to actually complete a risk assessment for their mental health, because I think that is a really big, powerful piece of tool as well if they are engaging with local authority officers or other authorities, so that they really understand the impact on the victim as well and how it's made them feel. So I'll just talk very quickly about a situation that I have with a client where top floor flat, three young girls were living, and underneath there was a single lady with two small children. One child would be up at 3 o'clock in the morning, banging its cot against the wall constantly. And this was a really big problem for the girls. And the clients went and spoke a number of times to the lady, and she didn't really bite, really. She didn't really take it. And unfortunately, no evidence at that point was taken. So I was able to intervene at that point, and we used some of the documents in the landlord toolbox. We used the diary notes so the girls could start writing down the patterns of behaviour and what they were putting up with. And we also did the risk assessment. So the girls were able to explain the impact. It's on a scale of 1 to 10, actually, that form. And they say, how has this affected your mental health? Has it made you nervous? And they are able to give a picture of the impact of the incidents over a period of time. That piece of risk assessment gathering probably was the most powerful tool in engaging the single mum underneath, the mother, and her engaging with the impact that the behaviour was having of her 3-year-old at 2 and 3 in the morning. And it was something that she was then responsive to. I think she moved the cot away from the wall. She was her getting out of bed responding to him a lot earlier. And things kind of subsided and were manageable after that. So the challenges facing the landlords is knowing how to intervene, what needs to be done, and also early evidence gathering if you need to take it, if you were needing to take it to its final polarised point, which would be a court application if a tenant wouldn't leave. You need the evidence. You need to make a complete pattern and picture of what's been going on. And the landlord's toolbox, which is something, was handed from you to the course and is shared when anyone comes on the course. It's vital, really vital.
Thank you, Sue. I think what strikes me there as you talk is a couple of things, really. I mean, one is about how a lot of the processes that are already embedded, one would hope, very well in local authority ASB teams, in social housing ASB teams, like the importance of evidence gathering, like getting victims to fill in diary sheets or keep notes other ways, like using risk assessments to really understand the harm of the behaviour to the victims. Those things that we kind of do day in, day out in the social housing sector, they're not embedded yet within the private rented sector in terms of private landlords using some of those things. I mean, your example of the baby with the cot is a brilliant one, because I'm sure that actually that was about opening eyes and about the mum seeing actually the impact that the behaviour was having that she probably hadn't even considered before. So a lot of the time with ASB, particularly the more kind of not neighbour disputes, but where there's a bit of noise in one property that's affecting the other side, there's never usually any intention from the household that's causing the noise. They're not doing it intentionally to cause ASB or nuisance most of the time. And actually, the first job really is to just explain that to them. And, you hope 9 times out of 10 people are quite reasonable. And once they hear the impact their behaviour is having, that's enough to make them try and temper that noise and be considerate of other people. I suppose what comes into my mind is that, you know, if you are a private landlord listening to some of this, it might be, particularly if you've never experienced problems with ASB within the properties that you own, some of this stuff might come as quite a surprise, because I imagine, and this isn't meant to be disrespectful at all, because I can certainly understand why, but a lot of private landlords maybe get into the trade because they see it as a, you know, perhaps they've inherited a property from their parents and they see it as a nice way of making a little bit of extra source of income, not even anticipating that there could be situations like this coming up in the future. And I think perhaps there's a certain amount of perhaps naivety around some of this stuff. And I'm sure you see that yourself, Sue, where, you know, landlords only come once there is a problem, because they never really thought that owning and renting a property could be so problematic.
Yeah, I think so. And sometimes they're taken off guard. And this is what I was saying, what challenges do the private landlords face? Well, understanding that actually they can intervene, they need to, they do have a duty of care for their tenants, but at the end of the day, they do have tools, and if they're educated and helped along the way, they say, for example, the landlord toolbox, which, as a, you know, you've said, is used far more within housing associations, etc. Using it in the private sector can help to manage, contain, and to stop the situation escalating into something very unpleasant for between the two of them, it's an HMO, and for other people who live with them, or just within a single let between neighbours. You know, you can get very good results. Most people, on the whole, are quite reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's like you say, it's opening the eyes. And the result we got from the mum downstairs was great. And she was a lot more contrite and sorry once she read the risk assessments that we shared with her. So they were quite powerful.
And I mean, that's brilliant, because of course no one wants to end up in a situation where a single mum and her child is being made homeless, because, mm-hmm. you know, the intervention didn't happen early enough, and perhaps it went straight to enforcement. So mm-hmm. that being proportionate and being fair and trying to resolve and maintain tenants is of course always very important. Yeah, so I think it's great, and what I've always found very refreshing about speaking to you, Sue, is this understanding and realization that there is a role for private landlords to play in tackling ASB. You know, it's not let's just hand it over to the police or let's just hand it over to the local authority. It's their problem. That real understanding that as the private landlord, you hold the tenancy agreement, and therefore there are things that you need to do to try and resolve issues. But of course, we do also fully appreciate, and we talk about this a lot in the e-course, that private landlords don't have a huge amount of tools. You know, of course, they hold the tenancy agreement, which is great. But the other tools in the ASB toolkit, like injunctions, closure powers, etc., they don't have legal recourse to those. So, of course, there are going to be times where a private landlord is going to need the support of community safety partners like police or local authority officers. From your point of view, what do you think that local authorities can do to best support private landlords who might be experiencing ASB within their stock?
Well, I think being available and being contactable and being transparent to be found, I think those are the key points that I came about in my own experience dealing with ASB and some of my own properties and with working with other clients. I'll give you a first-hand experience. I tried to find a local authority ASB officer in a certain area and didn't respond to the emails, didn't respond to the contactable telephone number that was put on the website that I have to say took me a while in that local authority to find. I contacted her and found her on Facebook. The name was on the website. I managed to find the name, and I went on to Facebook. And when I went on Facebook, and her profile was open, who she was, I had found her, and I private messaged her. And then I have to say she was brilliant. She came back within probably 40 seconds. I had apologised when I messaged her and said I don't particularly like doing this, but I have emailed you on two occasions. But she did come back straight away and apologise. So, but what we do know from that is that the information on the local authority website, you know, whether it was current or not, I don't know. But what was happening was the email wasn't being opened or looked at wherever I was sending it. Meanwhile, the situation was escalating. Things were getting more serious. I'm thinking about this particular incident with the chap who was on the suspended sentence, and things were getting quite serious and violent in the house. So just being available and knowing how to contact them, maybe local authorities or the ASB teams or whatever label they have, because they can be called many different things and many different authorities. But if they are able to engage with maybe larger organisations, with the National Resident Landlords Association or smaller landlord organisations, or just have a contactable and identifiable profile. That's the first step for landlords, so they know where to go. Because I have to say, I meet many landlords who are often, by the time they talk to me, at their wits' end with the problem they've got, and they don't know that the help is out there. Having said that, I think the ASB officers who are very good and functioning in their areas, I'm thinking of Cheshire, for example, and the lady I was dealing with in her local authority, they were very active and very connected to the local police as well. So if the ASB is around 8, 9 and 10, they'll maybe monitoring that or talking to the police who are partnered with them. I would say again, from my experience, it can depend on how strong that relationship is. For example, the lady I was speaking to, the ASB officer, there was a particular police officer that she would wait until he was back on again to be able to get more information and share information. And there was one particular one where she said, I don't really have a relationship with him, so I don't want to approach him. So that was very interesting. So even within those setups, you've got it's very reliant on the relationships and the people, the key people in those places, of how well those function, from my observations. But once they, if it's established, my feeling is that once it's established, from my experience, they actually work very powerfully together. For example, the ASB officer is in some form of triage. I learned over the time of working with her, she had a special triage connection with the police officers. They would be able to look at ASB that had gone into certain legal processes, be able to tell you when there would be a court date, would let you know. Obviously, they have to be very careful about the information they pass on, need to know only GDPR and data protection in place. All that said, they are very well informed with the police, if the police are involved and the relationships are working well. But it's about the landlords knowing that. And the only way the landlords are going to know that is if the local authorities reach out to them, and the ASB officers attend local meetings, or contact where the private landlords live. And when I say live, I don't mean in their homes. I mean where they live, in communities and in organisations, so that landlords do know there's an ASB officer. I just wonder how many landlords think about this. It's one of those things, and I would say for the course that we ran as well, many landlords will come on the course when they've actually got to a point where they need help, you know, and they need to understand what's going on. And, you know, and as you know, the course pulls all that together in terms of the landscape of the local authority, the private landlord, where we are now. And I know we're going to talk a little bit later about the changes that have come for landlords and possession, if it gets to that point and the landlord has to make those options. But also knowing what the powers, the local authority powers have, and the ASB officer working with the police teams can get very, you know, can go through legal court processes. And so I'm talking about, you know, premises being closed down if there's drugs going on. But at that point, the landlord will have known about that because the police will have contacted them, etc., etc. Unfortunately, the long game, if for the landlord in that situation will be that if action is taken and it is that serious and there is a closure notice on the property, working with the local authority and the police have taken to that stage, is really the landlord's premises are closed down for 6 months. They may still have a mortgage to pay on that. They might still have outgoings, service charges with its leasehold property. But it won't. They cannot return to the property or let it out for a minimum of 6 months, possibly. So these are quite serious long term, effects if the landlord isn't engaged early enough. But the idea, I guess, is to let, because every local authority is different, is that they reach out to the landlords. The landlords seem to be reaching out the other way when the situations have come. It's not like every landlord will walk around. I suspect lots of landlords will know who the housing manager is and who the environmental health officer is. I wonder how many will know who the antisocial behaviour officer is in their local authority.
No, I think you make a really good point there. And again, just to kind of pick up on some of the things that you said that I think are particularly important for listeners to take away. You know, I think that very, just very practical thing that you started off with, which is, are our web pages on local authorities up to date? You know, do they actually have the correct contact details? Is it worth actually putting very explicitly on those front facing web pages how a private landlord contacts the ASB team? And again, from a very practical point, like you say, there are very different labels sometimes on these teams, depending on, you go from one Midlands authority to the next, and you've got an ASB team in one, and you've got a community safety team in another, and a public protection team in another, and an environmental protection services in another. And at their heart, they're all ASB services. They've just been given a different moniker. And I think that can make it very difficult for, private landlords to know where they're going and who to go to. And I think, you're absolutely right. I had a wry smile on my face when you were talking about, the impacts that closure orders have on private landlords, because actually, we're talking very much about landlords that want to tackle the ASB. And unfortunately, there are a small minority, one would hope, of private landlords that actually would rather stick their head in the sand or are perhaps part of the problem. And I remember when I used to work at a local authority that, meeting with those private landlords whose tenants were causing all kinds of nuisance and essentially saying to them, look, I can be your best friend or I can be your worst nightmare. You can either work with me and I will help you in terms of things like serving Section 21 notices. And, the police will serve those for you because you may well be frightened yourself of your own tenants. But you need to work with us. Otherwise, we will look at things like putting a closure order on your property because we won't have any other choice. And we've got serious drug dealing and threatening behaviour and aggressive behaviour that we need to take some form of action. And if that has to be closure orders, then so be it. So I think the closure order can be a very effective stick in those small percentage of cases where perhaps the landlord isn't playing ball as well. I think there's probably some local authorities that on hearing, that kind of advice about, well, make sure how to contact you is very obvious. Their first concern might be, but we're really busy already. How on earth can we possibly take on all private rented sector problems as well when we're already busy? So why would we open that door to people? And I think it really is that appreciation that ASB that's happening in the private rented sector is a partnership problem, and it's got to be a partnership where the private landlord is perhaps doing more of this stuff that you've spoke about so eloquently, Sue, around, looking at ABCs and opening those dialogues of conversation between parties where it's appropriate to do so. But actually, when it gets to the point where, eviction is going to take far too long, and in the meantime, the suffering's still going to continue. So actually, what we really need is some closure powers in place so that the problems stop much sooner than the eviction process can occur, that's available as well. I just think that it's, partnership is about give and take. And it strikes me that in particularly more complex issues of ASB in the private rented sector, it really is a partnership problem that everybody needs to play a part in resolving.
I think, Yes, entirely. The ASB officer I spoke about, who I contacted on Facebook when she did get involved, she was absolutely brilliant. I explained how I understood her relationships with the police. She also offered, there was one tenant that was left in the HMO who was from Nigeria, and he had nowhere to go because, his home was in Nigeria. The other two tenants went back to their mums and dads. They lived in the UK. And she offered him a safe place, an alternative accommodation, emergency accommodation, at a drop of hat if it became intolerable, and off and on it was, but he never really wanted to leave. And at that point, I think the perpetrator was being monitored. So she was incredibly helpful and supportive in dealing with the actual danger. What I was aware of was that there was a point where, when we were going for eviction and we were talking to the police, where she said, my power's finished now. I can't get involved in the eviction process. But what I can do is work with keeping everyone as safe as possible and raise awareness through the other agencies." And she also was able to talk to probation, which, who wouldn't talk to me? My clients, they wouldn't talk to the landlord or the representative because of data protection and GDPR. But she was able to go behind the scenes and alert probation to what was happening. And not long after that, the tenant I was telling you about, who was on the suspended sentence, started having regular welfare checks from the police, which he hadn't been having before, which helped monitor and maybe just take an edge off some of the behaviour in the house.
Lovely. Can I ask you a question that's almost like the other side of the last question I asked you, really, which was about, how can landlords reach out to local authorities? I think the other thing I said, about looking at the other side of the coin, one of the things I hear from local authorities very often is that sometimes it can be very difficult to engage a private landlord. So what advice would you have from anyone who's working in a local authority listening in, or perhaps police, about how they can best sort of touch in with private landlords, how they can, practically, how do you get hold of them? And is there any tips you have around getting the best from them when that conversation does begin?
Well, I think I would like to think that most landlords would at some point do a visit and get some idea that there is a problem at the house. Getting the landlord to engage with them, well, landlords are like bananas, they're all the same but different. And what they have to do is understand this, the how important it is and the duty of care they have. So just before we talk about them working with them, I think the landlords have got to understand that if extreme 8, 9, 10 drugs dealing, etc., is going up their property, drugs being grown at the property, that will actually invalidate their house insurance, which is really, really vital. And so they need to be aware of how extreme and how difficult a situation, if it escalates, might take them to. I think it's also about the understanding that the police are there to support you and to help you. As I said, the welfare checks by the police were vital in one scenario I was working in. But it's that something that I'd have to think about more as a landlord. I think understanding and being transparent about what support you can actually get from the local authority, and also from and the other agencies involved, really.
Some of it, and thinking through that, some of it is about the approach that the local authority or police take. I think if it's very much a kind of, we're here to put fault in your corner, it's your tenant, you need to sort this out, then that's probably going to get the backup of the private landlord a little bit, who probably is aware of the problems and is also struggling and actually needs support, rather than being told that they need to find a solution when they know that they just don't know what the solution is. So I suppose some of it is, it's that classic relationship building, isn't it? It's about approaching in the right way. It's about, trying to reach some mutual understanding, trying to support each other, rather than, as I said, ringing the private landlord and saying, we've been told your tenant's a problem, you need to evict them, otherwise we'll take action against you. End of conversation.
I think you've hit the nail on the port. That was the point I was going to make, is that the landlords, if it's serious ASB, could be back on the back foot. and are concerned about the fact that it's on their premises, because that is actually a criminal offence if you're allowing it to be on the premises. So once that knowledge is accepted and identified, maybe put in writing somewhere, you know, the police are, you know, to be seen as a friendly helping hand rather than putting the landlord on the back foot. I think that message getting out, obviously we can't get around the law. The law is the law, whatever it says about, you know, drugs and drug stealing, but it's on your premises. But that ties into the insurance point as well. And my experience with dealing with one of the police forces was one of the chaps said to me with one of our clients, well, you'll just have to evict him. And I think that's really important, because I don't think they the understanding of how legal documents and agreements are put together. Because if you have four tenants on a joint and several agreement, so they're all jointly responsible for everything, if you evict one, you have to evict them all. So it's all very well to say, well, you need to get rid of them, you need to evict them or whatever. But actually, you can't without making the other three people homeless, because you have to bring the whole tenancy to an end. So that's not with all HMOs. Some HMOs will be set up, and I'm talking about HMOs only here, can be set up where people have a single room let. So they have a single tenancy with a shared use of the common areas. Now, if that's the case, then that person on their own can be evicted for ASB if we go down that route. And yeah, I know we're going to have a little talk about that in a moment. But the understanding of the police, you know, when I was talking to them, what was underlined to me was they just thought an eviction was a very simple process for one person in a house. It depends on the legal paperwork and the way it's been set up.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, whenever we talk about partnerships, whether it's partnerships between police and council, partnerships between housing and social care, partnerships between private landlords and councils, you know, what's very often at the root of the solution in terms of improving those relationships is making sure you each understand each other's roles and responsibilities and what's possible and what's not possible. Because the danger with the situation you present there is that if the police officer isn't educated in terms of what's possible, then their perception of the situation might be that the landlord is just being obstructive. So it's so important that we understand each other and that we take the time to do that. I'm very conscious of time. We don't have a huge amount of it left for this episode. It just flown by, I would say, Sue. But I can't leave this episode without talking to you a little bit about what's been proposed over, I suppose, sort of 18 months or so, really, in terms of the changes around private sector tenancies. Now, I'm aware that some of our listeners may not be used to working with private sector tenancies, and so may not have picked up on some of the changes that has been suggested. So I think it would be really helpful to start with, Sue, if you could just set the scene with kind of what's been discussed over the last sort of 18 months, 2 years in terms of private sector tenancies, and then perhaps where you see the future going.
Well, really, what's happened over the last 18 months or so is that Section 21, which is the no-fault route to possession, so a landlord can serve a notice, give 2 months' notice in the correct situation, and they can retrieve their property and go straight to the court for a possession order. They don't have to say why. The service of the Section 21 notice, and if the paperwork has all been set up correctly, and there's a lot of detail there, but that's for another day. When that's all set up properly, you can serve a Section 21. And a lot of the people who were maybe under the umbrella of ASB or committing ASB behaviour could be quietly moved along. That meant that they would just be moved along to the next landlord. Oddly enough, they may even get a good reference, if you follow my meaning, and then they would be able to be rehoused by the next folk, because it wasn't about non-payment of rent. It was just about, you know, on this circumstance, we need to remove that person, and just, you know, it's not working out. So somebody could get their home back, you know, they rented property back for Section 21 through Section 21, which I'll say the no-fault route to possession. That has been removed by the government process over consultation period. And what's happened now is that we are left only with the fault-based routes to possession. So antisocial behaviour falls under Section 14. There are something like 17 grounds of grounds that you can use to repossess your property, and ASB has not been used, this grant has not been used a great deal. And the reason why is because people have been able to move their tenants on with a Section 21. So what we have a situation now, which goes back possibly to the beginning when we were talking about gathering evidence, is that it's a fault-based route to possession. So you need to gather all the evidence as for the longest period you can, whatever scale of it might be. So that if you actually have to then put an application into the court and serve notice, that you've got the qualifying evidence to actually support a possession. And that might take a period of time to get the evidence, or it might be one or two large incidences. It depends. We don't know what we're looking at. Every situation is different. But what it does mean now is that there will always be a hearing when you go for it'll be under a Section 8, it'll be Ground 14, when you do go for a possession order. And it means that it's evidence-based, it's fault-based. It means that after that hearing, the tenant possibly could have a history which might affect the future of them renting in a small town or in a situation where lots of information is shared between landlords. And it also means that the process to remove a tenant can't be done swiftly under a Section 21. Also, the situation now, I think there could be an animosity between the landlord and tenant as you get this fault-based, you know, pointing finger, this is because of the reason why you're going. I mean, it's a Section 21, the tenant might have known, but it's not pointed out, it's not written down anywhere. Now with the Section 8 procedure, you would have to put it in the notice and then you would also have to recite it again in your application form, in your possession, in your N119, where you plead your case, and you have to put all the evidence there again, photographs, everything, maybe of the condition of the property, how they're living, who said what to who. And the important thing about that as well is, as it's a civil court, hearsay evidence is admissible, and we see that for the first time and on the balance of probabilities. So the test is against the value and strength of the evidence, and you can repeat what someone else has told you. Hearsay evidence is repeatable in the civil courts. It's not in the criminal courts, but this is not a criminal application. This is going to be a civil application for the repossession of your property. So we're going to see now a lot more landlords beginning to engage with ASB. Previously, ASB is something that may have irritated them, may have been at the core of lots of issues of tenancies not working out. But with a Section 21, everyone could go peacefully about their business into the night, and people moved on, and the landlord, without a hearing, would be able to get a possession order for their property, because it was on the quality of their paperwork that actually qualified them for that. Here, what we're seeing is a change completely under Section 8, where the ground has to be proved, evidence has to be acquired, and someone needs to go into court and actually support their application. So what we're seeing now is at the early part of the curve, I believe. We're right at before the curve, where this is all going to start moving, and a lot of the behaviour that would have probably generated a Section 21, other than non-payment of rent, which was why Section 21 was used as well. And a lot of the time, we're going to see now fault-based evictions, which mm-hmm. is going to take a lot of landlord time up, a lot of court process time. Is going to be incredibly expensive. If someone actually plays the court system, you could be looking at possibly up to £15,000 worth of costs to get asked to actually achieve the outcome, which is the possession order, and then enforcing it. If they still don't go, you'd have to go through the courts to enforce it, which is all expensive. And meanwhile, they may decided not to pay their rent on top of that. And meanwhile, the landlord may be left with a property they can't rent other than the tenant living in it. So I think watch this space, because I think antisocial behaviour is going to be a lot more, is something that's going to be talked about and be engaged with a lot more, which is why, of course, we put the course together with you, Janine, and why, you know, we've thought about this and discussed on many occasions how is the landlord going to be able to process this and actually repossess the property in extreme situations.
Absolutely. And I think this underpins so much of what we've spoken about in the last hour, which is, you know, it's let's be very clear. There are some very good reasons why the no-fault process for eviction in the private rented sector needs some kind of review, because what we don't want is a continuation of where, you know, we've got some irresponsible letting practices and we've got families being evicted for no reason. So there is a very good reason behind the review of the Section 21 process. But I think what we see very clearly is we're going to be moving to a position where it isn't possible for community safety partners to just turn around to private landlords and say, we'll just evict them, because it's not going to be as easy as it has perhaps been in the past. And I think all the things that we spoke about around intervening early, around the landlord playing a role in gathering evidence, around the landlord upskilling themselves in ASB, around partners being more willing to help, particularly in the more serious situations, is going to become even more important as we move to the future. Because if a landlord now is, it's going to take them perhaps longer to get possession than it does now, and we don't know what the future holds, but that's the fear, I guess, within the sector, then there may well be a need that in those serious cases where entire communities are being affected by ASB, that the police and local authorities are intervening during the time those possession proceedings are going through and looking at other options like perhaps community protection notices or closure orders. So unfortunately, we have come to the end of our time together, Sue. I've very much enjoyed speaking to you. I don't want to, you very cleverly, very neatly mentioned the ASB toolkit and the ASB training on a number of occasions. I think it would be remiss of me not to ask the obvious question, therefore, that if anybody is listening and thinking, well, that course sounds right for me, or perhaps they're from a council thinking, I've got some private landlords that I think could really benefit from that course, how do people find out more?
Well, they can contact me directly on my website, Sue Breyer, sue@landlordjacktraining.com. That's my website. You can Google, email me at sue@landlordtaxtraining.co.uk. And I think my partner and I, Don Robbie, will be putting together new dates for ASB shortly. We've just actually ran two or three courses in the last month or so. So new ones to be sorted, but that will be in the autumn. But if anyone wants to contact me and just register their interest, please do so.
Great. And I will include, when I post this episode to my website, I'll include your link to your details there as well, if that's okay. So
that would be great. Thank you.
So that just leaves me really to say a massive, massive thank you, Sue, for giving up your time, as I say, so generously to come along and describe what happens from a private landlord's point of view, some of those challenges, but also some of those real opportunities to engage private landlords a little bit more in the ASB agenda. As always, thank you everyone for taking the time to listen. If you have any thoughts about topics that you'd like to see covered in future episodes, or speakers that you'd love to listen to, or perhaps you have got the bug and the urge and you'd like to come and be one of my guests, you are absolutely more than welcome. You can contact me in the normal ways, so via my website, which is www.janinegreenasb.co.uk. You can reach out to me on Twitter, or indeed drop me an email at janine@janinegreenasb.co.uk. Until next time.